We're trying to conduct a serious scientific investigation.
Science, logic, reason.
Do you have any hard data?
Now, that's what I call science. You are listening to That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio show and podcast that brings you independent and hopefully interesting STEM, that's science, technology, engineering and maths content from Tasmania. This show is supported by Edge Radio, Hobart's premium youth station, so head to edgeradio.org.au for more information. My name's Neve Chapman. I'm joined this week by my co-host Meredith Castles. Hi, Meredith.
Hi, Neve. How are you going?
Good. How are you feeling on your first show?
Great.
That's awesome. Meredith usually does, you might have seen her name before, she does all of our post-production editing each week for the show, so it's great to have you on air with us today. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about, it's a tech focus, so we're going to be talking about artificial intelligence. We've got a completely awesome and jam-packed panel. So we've got Dr. Paris Butfield from Secret Lab. What is Secret Lab?
It's a game development company.
I thought I've heard of it before. It's a specifically game, doesn't do like web pages or anything like that.
Oh, no. Oh, absolutely not. No, just games. Yeah.
We've got Dr. John Manning, again from Secret Lab, and Dr. Tim Nugent from Secret Lab and Lonely Coffee. So, Meredith, what are we talking about today?
Right. Well, we're talking about a mixture of AI, which is artificial intelligence. And in particular, we're going to a bit of a theme. Paris, John, Tim and I did a panel at PAX Oz 2019 on Let's Train an AI to Play a Game.
What's PAX?
PAX is the Australian Gaming Culture Convention, the Australian one, and it's held every year at the Melbourne Convention Centre.
Cool. Yeah. So what kind of things do you do?
PAX is all sorts of things. It's kind of focused on popular culture around games for anything. So there's like a big section about just people playing board games. There's actually a section where people can get together and actually play video games. There's a lot of talks and panels from ranging from giant AAA companies sending down people to talk about their newest and greatest games, as well as smaller sort of focused things such as like ourselves, where we were talking about a much more niche topic.
Okay, cool. So it's pretty representative, but it's not necessarily just tech and making games in the context of like video gaming or computer gaming.
I mean, the general theme is games and popular culture, but it's definitely not development focused. It's consumption focused.
Awesome. So what are we delving into?
Okay, so as we promised at PAX Oz, we did a panel called Let's Train an AI to Play a Game. We promised everybody who came that we were going to train one live on stage in front of them, and the opponent and the AI would go against each other in a game.
Cool, so you had to do that live on stage. Mm. How long does it take to train an AI?
That really depends on what you want to do. So what we ended up showing at the end of our panel, like the final product, was we actually trained a four-legged robot, spider-like robot, to run around a obstacle-filled environment, pursuing a target, recovering from being knocked over. We would have obstacles pushing into it, and it would. There's a really famous video from Boston Dynamics, which is a real-world robot manufacturing company, and they show a quadrupedal robot being kicked, and it kind of stumbles and recovers. And so we were able to do that inside of our environment as well.
By inside your environment, you mean inside a computer environment. It's not a physical robot running around and recovering.
No, that's much more expensive.
Yes, I thought so.
So the reason we did this at PAX, the gaming convention, is because we're using a game engine to do AI. And a game engine, it turns out, can do enough of the real world to be a really good place to simulate things that are kind of representative of the real world. So a robot that walks.
By a game engine, do you mean literally something that runs a game?
Technology that is used to build a game.
Yeah.
The underlying technology of a game.
So we've already been guilty of the first cardinal sin on our show, which is using a term and not explaining what the term is. Yes. Can somebody explain what AI is, please?
This is one of those ones where everyone has their own definition. I would say AI, short for artificial intelligence, is a research field trying to build computer systems that can do things by themselves, is the very high-level thing. That tends to get then broken down into sort of subfields. So systems which can look at a picture and tell you if there's a dog in there, for example. That's part of AI. That's computer vision. It's a subgroup of AI. AI that tries to win chess. That's an AI. You know, it's part of game-playing AI and so on. So it's sort of an overall branch. It's sort of an umbrella of which there's multiple little branches of sub AI fields, I guess you'd say.
So our listeners may have heard of different terms such as artificial intelligence and machine learning. What's the key differences between the two?
I would say machine learning is one of those branches of AI. Machine learning is kind of a very specific type of AI. It was actually at a conference recently. It was an AI conference. And one of the things they noticed was there's actually a marketing shift. Even though what most people are currently doing is technically machine learning, there's a bit of a marketing shift to just call it AI because that seems to, you know, sell better with people. But it's just one of those branches of artificial intelligence, its own sort of dedicated field inside of it. The thing that's sort of interesting about machine learning is, as the name implies, the machine learns how to solve the problem completely, well, semi-completely by itself is sort of the general idea. So it's designed, as originally envisaged, it's inspired by the way your brain works. So you've got these big complex neural nets inside your head, and machine learning sort of replicates their vision and their dream in a completely different way. So it's inspired by your biological brain, but works nothing at all like it.
So the field of AI that kind of the field was obsessed with prior to machine learning is symbolic AI. And symbolic AI was what everyone was sort of frothing at the mouth at about in the 80s and the 90s. And it's kind of a rule set based AI where you define a list of rules that the thing that you are giving AI to follows. And it kind of executes those rules and does exceptions based on those rules. Whereas machine learning is a much more sort of organic approach where you're theoretically creating neurons in a brain that can kind of learn and figure out what's going on.
Well, what are the big disadvantages to either of those approaches?
I mean, I'm not a huge expert in symbolic, in the symbolic side of AI, but with machine learning, the real disadvantage is sort of, as you said, you need to have this well-planned and well-thought-out data set which you can use to train it so it can learn how to solve these problems. And if there's flaws in the data set, there's going to be flaws in the machine learning. That doesn't mean it's not necessarily useful. It just means you have to be wary about what you teach it, because it's very easy to teach it the wrong thing.
At this point, there is so much data out there, and it is so trivially easy compared to how hard it used to be to train something using that data, using machine learning techniques, that you can make an AI that is going to predict something that's totally wrong very easily. So there's something going around right now on the internet where some guy who is not a medical, not a virologist, not a medical background, he's just an AI researcher who thinks he knows what he's doing, trained in AI, using machine learning techniques based on the spread of the COVID-19 coronavirus.
Oh, yeah.
And predicted that it would like eradicate humanity within 6 months or something, just because the AI learnt that the chart is going up, and without in the absence of other data, it was like, well, humanity's going to be dead.
Yeah,
and
wow.
It's obviously not accurate or useful to do that.
Like, at that moment, I'd like to plug our excellent episode on coronavirus just last week. Well, 2 weeks ago by the time this goes to air. It was very good. It's got a lot of uptake. Go get some facts from some experts.
Absolutely. Just touching on that as well, our AI at the panel used reinforcement learning as a training technique. Can you just speak a little bit about that, what that actually means to listeners?
Yes, I can do that. The way that reinforcement learning works is basically you give your system the idea of a reward. You create a system by which when it performs certain tasks, when it performs certain actions in the world, it either gets a positive signal or a negative signal. So positive means reward, negative means punishment. And you have it run over time. You start out with completely random behavior, and over time it begins to associate, when I do these actions in this order, then I get a reward. When I do anything else, I get a punishment. And eventually it learns that the highest possible reward that it can get is the kind of behavior that leads to walking. So it is thinking in terms of, I will rotate my left arm this way and my right leg in this way, and I get information about where my legs are, where my goal is, and other physical information about the world. And it then converts it into what action to take next, and then it gets given a reward or a punishment. And over time, it learns to optimize for maximum reward.
What kinds of rewards or punishments can you even give something that, you know, maybe doesn't have emotional intelligence?
So when we say reward, this is a kind of anthropomorphizing that we tend to apply to machine learning, and it isn't necessarily correct, because when you say, oh, here's a reward, it's like,
I think chocolate.
Yeah, exactly. You think like giving a dog a treat. Like, it's the same kind of metaphor, but the metaphor doesn't go the entire way. So when I say reward, what I really mean is a number will be either bigger than zero or less than zero. And the system is designed to try and make that number be very, very, very high away from zero. That's all it is. We call that reward. But that isn't necessarily it going, yummy, I love rewards. It doesn't have any concept of that. It's just trying to make a number big.
Okay, so in like an applied setting, we could say we want them to make a positive diagnosis for cancer. And for each negative one, we're like, nope. And then, but each positive one, it keeps accumulating and going higher.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's pretty interesting. I didn't know that.
And there's actually been a lot of research done in cancer detection with machine learning, where there's been some melanoma research done where there was some very successful projects and some very unsuccessful projects. And the unsuccessful one's really interesting because what they technically taught the AI to reward itself over was to identify rulers, because all of the cancer, all the patients who had cancer happened to have rulers next to their melanomas. So the AI actually learned that having a ruler in a picture gets you a reward, not actually detecting cancer. So you can very easily teach these things something completely useless.
There was a military AI that somebody trained at one point where they were trying to detect tanks in satellite pictures, and their training data happened to use pictures of tanks from a specific satellite only, and the AI learned that there's a very small image anomaly in the corner of the image, and that means there's a tank in the picture. Hmm. And because its training data only had tanks in pictures with that image anomaly, it only knew how to detect tanks when there was that image anomaly from that certain satellite.
It learned how to recognize photos from that satellite, not the contents of the photos.
Interesting.
I think Guacamole Cat needs to be touched on this, because one of the most popular hashtags from PAX I hear is our Guacamole Cat hashtag. Now, the story behind that was we gave specific visual examples on the panel of some of the things that AI is not good at necessarily as well as what it is good at. And one of these was the Guacamole Cat. So it is a picture, the AI was given a picture of a cat with overlaid with a pattern of noise.
Yeah, it was just, if you were to look at the noise separately, it just looks like coloured speckles.
Yeah, exactly. And it had about 90-ish percent accuracy that it was actually guacamole. That's what it recognised it as. But rotating it slightly, it became a cat again.
Yeah, this is an example of what's called an adversarial attack on an image classifier. So basically, the image classifying algorithms, these machine learning examples, they're very, very good at finding specific elements in a photo or other image, and it uses that to classify, okay, this is a cat, this is a banana, this is a car. But they're not thinking of it in the same way as the human brain thinks of when it looks at an image and tries to classify what that thing is. And so by manipulating the very specific pixel values that lead to the conclusion this is a cat or this is guacamole, a person can create an image that any human being will recognize as containing one thing, but the machine learning model will be completely confident that it is in fact this completely different thing. And so it becomes possible to trick those kinds of things.
Cool, that's a really good point, John. So, Paris, did you want to jump in there? Or
yeah, I was just going to say that's the same approach as the makeup people have been wearing to thwart facial recognition in public. So it's an adversarial attack on AI.
So I think, John, one of the things that you were saying there kind of speaks to me about what a lot of medical research in particular taunt as being the era of machine learning, is that it can spot things that humans can't, and that, you know, yes, it will piece together a puzzle in a different way and come to a different conclusion than we would. But that's because, you know, it's maybe been in a test environment for like 6 months, let's say, whereas we've been essentially in a test environment making decisions with lots of social cues and stuff for our whole entire lives. So we're like, oh, yes, it's yellow and it's got brown spots, so it is a banana, where it might be like, no, it's yellow, it's a ball. But what are your thoughts on that machine learning can, because it doesn't have all that social prejudice and context prejudice that we have, that it can spot patterns that we actually can't?
So machine learning will find a pattern even if there isn't one. So if there's that hilarious website, I don't know if it still exists anymore. It used to be called Spurious Correlations. And you could see how like the rise in it was like cancers correlates exactly with the decrease in piracy in East Africa, sort of thing. Like all these weird
totally
correlations.
Positive, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
If you give a machine learning algorithm a bunch of data, it will find a relationship even if there isn't one there, because it just keeps going until it finds something.
And that might not be a meaningful one, I suppose, and it takes somebody who understands the context to really determine, is this something that's actually causative, or is it just... That's so fascinating, because I work predominantly in blood pressure research, where there's these waveforms that like have float variables of the hundreds and thousands that we just cannot interpret. We use two measurements, the upper and the bottom of the waveform, whereas everyone's touting that machine learning will be able to interpret all of these different things. And I'm like, but it has to understand, critically analyze, and then make sense of that information.
For tasks where a human needs to use their like human judgment, AI can not replace the human right now, and probably won't be able to for a long time, but it can augment the human and make the human faster at what they're doing. And a really good example of this is airport security. When you put your bags on the conveyor belt at airport, the scanners, the screens that people are looking at are hooked up to machine learning algorithms which can highlight like bombs and highlight guns and highlight batteries. And they draw like a red box around something they can't recognize. So they can draw people's attention, the human operator, to their attention to things they should be looking at, but not make the call themselves.
Another point, you mentioned machine learning models don't have the context or cultural information that informs a decision. A machine learning system is only aware of the data that you give it. And so if you are either deliberately or unconsciously selective of that data that goes into it, then you end up recreating the same kind of bias that you as a human being can't avoid having.
Couldn't you even end up inadvertently amplifying that bias?
You absolutely do, especially when you use those machine learning model systems to drive future decisions.
Yeah, there was a really excellent example of this in judicial systems in the United States where they programmed it to say what the reincarceration rates were, the reoffending rates were, but they inherently, they didn't put race into the model, but they inherently had factors that were linked to race in the model. So essentially this AI or this machine learning model was had massively been like, no, do not give parole to black people that were incarcerated. But compared to white people, it's like, oh yeah, no, they're probably not going to reoffend. Yeah, like just, and it was completely, it had no appropriate social context.
It's very easy to go, oh, we don't include race as a parameter. But you can go, but we do include which neighborhood they're from.
Yeah, but we have these five other things that essentially amount to race.
Machine learning is very good at uncovering what are called latent variables, which are variables effectively hidden in the data. Even if you deleted that part of the data, if there's enough correlations in the data, it will rediscover them. That's what you've got to be really careful. You got to, the real art in machine learning is selecting and training it, not actually using them. Using them is actually pretty straightforward once you've got it trained.
One of my favorite latent examples, like Tim just said, is actually a employment company in America that made a resume scanning robot that they ingested a whole bunch of resumes and used it to predict performance for job interviews and stuff. It turns out the best predictors for a job in the tech world, I think, were that your name is Jared and that you played lacrosse in high school.
That's really funny. Alrighty, well, you've been listening to That's What I Call Science. We had a big old intro to artificial intelligence there. Hope you're enjoying the show and stay tuned for a little bit more on this topic with our special guests. You are listening to That's What I Call Science. My name is Neve Chapman. I'm joined with my co-host Meredith Castles. We also have in studio three special guests, Dr. Paris Butfield, Dr. John Manning, and Dr. Tim Nugent. Thanks so much, guys, for making the time. So you're essentially all from Secret Lab. So you collaborate together working on that company that specializes in game development. And we've been talking about artificial intelligence and the PAX panel, which I'm going to simplify as a gaming convention that's held in Australia.
That's good.
Yep. So Meredith, do you want to kick us off with our next question?
Absolutely. So just passing on over to you guys, why did we decide to do an AI panel and why do we think that it was something that people wanted to know?
I think that, so AI has been a part of video games for a very, very long time. Single player games rely on some degree of participation from the computer. And so we call that in game development the AI. Now, that can be a very different kind of thing to what in the larger industries we now call AI. So, like, image classification tends not to be in video games, but we kind of use the same label twice. So we thought it was really important to give people an understanding of what we mean when we talk about AI in the broader context, what is involved when you build a system that is trying to play either against or with a human being. Towards the end of our demonstration at the panel, we actually sat an audience member down in front of the computer and got them to play against our trained AI. They didn't win. They didn't win at all. They got 2 points to the AI's
47.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, that's like a spanking. That's not even just like slightly worse.
That's right.
But is that like, you know, I always lost to the computer nearly every time I played a game. Is that what all of the inherent, you know, player versus computer essentially systems operate on?
So when you are designing a game, the strength and the skill of the AI is part of the game's design in as much as how high you can jump. So the goal of a good AI is to lose to the player by just the right amount. So it's not trying to beat you. The goal of a game AI designer is not to make the best AI. We know how to do that. As we saw in our panel, it's quite easy to make a system that's way better than a human being can be, because the computer can react much, much faster than a human being. They can aim much more correctly, but that's not fun.
So essentially, they're like making it just easy enough. Isn't that kind of like, I don't know, now I feel like the goalposts are like artificially set, and I'm like, oh, I don't know how I feel about this.
games are primarily an entertainment medium, so if it was too hard, no one would be entertained. So, I mean, it's not so much that games are trying to lie to you and tell you haven't achieved anything. It's more they're here to provide you with a bit of entertainment and some exploration of something. If the game was too hard, you wouldn't get to explore it. You wouldn't get to enjoy it. So it's sort of... Game AI is, like John said, it's kind of a balancing act. It needs to be tricky enough that you feel challenged, but easy enough that you feel you can beat it. Whereas the AI we made was purely just a absolutely, like, hard, as hard as it could, crushing machine at defeating anything you threw at it. And it shows. It annihilated anyone who you could throw up against it.
Our reinforcement system was trained to maximize that reward that we talked about in the first segment. And so it got very good at maximizing that reward. It had no concept of trying to let someone else be okay as well.
So do you find, like maybe Paris, do you find that there's a lot of misconceptions about AI and the context in which it operates? Like, I've always known that the computer is, again, the thing I'm playing against, but I never thought of that as AI. So do you find people have a lot of misconceptions?
Yes, very much so. People think all sorts of things that are AI that are not really AI, that are just like a set of rules that something has been checked against. People think things that are not AI are AI, and vice versa all the time. I think particularly in video games, people attribute a lot of human emotions to AI. So like people think something's coming to get them when it's not. Things like that. Video games particularly use lots of tricks to make people feel like the AI is cleverer than it is. Like in a video game where you might be fighting soldiers, the soldiers often shout flanking when they do absolutely anything, and the player thinks they're flanking because of the certain behavior they did, when the AI is actually just shouting that regardless of what it's doing, and people believe it because they think they ascribe human feelings to things. So yes, people have lots of misconceptions, and particularly in video games, which are basically just glorified trickery, it happens a lot.
Is that really the key messages we wanted people to take away from the panel?
I think the key message we want to take away is what is the modern take on AI, really, is what I think the main takeaway was. How do you make one of these sort of modern AI? Realistically, it was a panel on what is machine learning? How do these machine learning AIs work? What can they do? What are they good at, sort of thing? And hopefully make it entertaining.
Another thing is that as people become more aware of the fact that machine learning systems are in place all around the world, and throughout your day, you'll commonly encounter some kind of machine learning system. Even limited to just if you search for one thing on Google in the morning, then you've triggered off an enormous amount of AI research. At least the results of that research. So we wanted to show people what is behind that curtain. We wanted to make it a bit less opaque, because one of the real risks that we have in the field of computer science is because AI systems are being used and they're very, very back of the room, hidden behind a curtain. You give it a question, it comes back with an answer, but you have no real reason to trust why that answer is the way that it is. It becomes more important these days to have some kind of understanding of what an AI system really is trying to do and how it's doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. You know, AI systems are pretty prolific at the minute. So are data management policies. And I mean, the most valuable commodity, if you can consider it that, that most people have now is our data. And that's what people are paying extortionate amounts of money to access. So I think you're right that we need to create interesting and captivating dialogue around these types of issues that make people actually want to engage with it and critically think about it and what they want to sign up to. Hope you're enjoying the show, and stay tuned for a little bit more on this topic with our special guests. You are listening to That's What I Call Science. My name is Neve Chapman. I'm joined with my co-host Meredith Castles. We also have in studio with Dr. Paris Butfield, Dr. John Manning, and Dr. Tim Nugent. One thing we always try to do on this show is talk about the future directions and, you know, try and be empowering or like give a message of like what people need to think about. So what do you see really as the future directions or the future things that we need to consider for AI use in any context?
I would say probably the main one is you need to be aware that these things exist is really, really probably one of the biggest ones, because they're going to start getting used more. They're going to start getting used more even if they're bad ideas to be used. There's already a bunch of this stuff happening where machine learning products are being used when it's not proven that it can actually solve the problem, but they're still applying it, like the judicial system you mentioned. There's no evidence that would actually be useful, yet they still went and applied it. I think you kind of got to learn, you've got to know enough about how they sort of work so you can start going, hang on, I think there's something weird going on here, and challenging it. There's a real fear, I think. At its core, you should never trust anything a computer fully does by itself. Not because the computer's going to make a mistake, but because you can't blame a computer. You can only blame a person for a thing. So if a computer ruins your life, you need to be able to find the person who you can then go, hang on, you ruined my life, and that's not okay. Like the RoboDebt thing with Centrelink, for example.
Yeah. Slight disclaimer there. I'm not sure if that judicial system example was actually implemented or if it was just researched and tested beforehand, but I'll have to double check. Did you want to jump in, John?
Yeah, so around the mid-2010s, there began this trend of companies hiding behind the algorithm. You'd often hear news stories of like, oh, you know, it's not our fault that we classify in a discriminatory way. It's just the algorithm. But algorithms are written by humans.
Exactly. You've got to find the person who's essentially informed those assumptions that have been written into it. And I think, you know, I'm assuming we're pretty much all researchers, and I would always encourage constant rigorous evaluation of how things are performing. My biggest interest is, you know, how can we use machine learning or modern systems to be continually value adding and improving healthcare structures so that we're essentially using the tech to our advantage rather than just being like, nope, it worked in the 90s and we will keep doing it that way and we'll just stick with it because changing it would be too hard. Whereas we just need to look at how is it performing? Can we get, you know, 1% to 2% better?
Yeah, I think one problem that we currently have with a lot of this stuff is even though the science and maths behind a lot of this stuff was actually developed in the 1950s, computers weren't powerful enough to do it until quite recently. So we're kind of in like almost like a gold rush feel where we're just trying anything. I think it'll start to settle down because all this AI research does have extremely useful applications. I think we just need to get used to the idea of like you don't have to create an AI that can have a meaningful conversation with you. You can create an AI which can tell a doctor, hey, I think your patient might have cancer. And then it still falls to the doctor to double check, look at it, investigate themselves and go, yes, I agree, or no, you're being, you know, slightly paranoid AI. And I think that's okay. We just have to sort of, I think we're just in the moment getting caught up in the moment. We're just like, hey, look at this. I can do this. I can throw the data at it and get an answer. We need to get a little bit better at going, okay, but what's the problem we want to solve? Let's solve this one specific problem and then worry about how to move on from there.
Just grabbing onto that, in terms of just the AI that, for example, you built, John, and team, what was there anything that surprised you?
The thing that really shocked us was the thing that happened on stage when we were demonstrating, look, it runs around, look, it can navigate this obstacle-filled environment. We set up its target to move around, and so we're using it to go, look, it can adjust. It isn't just walking forward, it can make turns, it can walk around an obstacle. But what we had forgotten was that the obstacle, which moves around randomly, still had a physical shape to it. So it had like physical presence in the world. And so because it moved randomly, at one point, it moved directly into the robot, began to push it. And it pushed it so hard and so fast that the robot was pushed up and left staggering on its tippy toes. This is a four-legged robot, so it's standing, basically doing a handstand. And it's an I'm up on stage. We're in front of how many people were in the audience? Like, 300?
I don't know. It was pretty big.
A lot of people. And so I was going, oh no, this is going to look really silly in front of everyone. And our robot is doing a handstand and begins to like make little shifting motions and lands perfectly on all four of its legs and recovers with the most incredible grace and poise I had never expected to see. And I was stunned. We actually got video footage of this, and so if there's a way that we can link to people,
We all slightly cheered, I think, because we were just so surprised that it happened. Because I mean, you shouldn't think of AI as a kid, but if you think of it as a kid, this thing was actually only about 2 weeks old, and it just got hit clean in the face by a high speed moving brick, and then not only did a handstand land it back correctly and kept walking without, you know, any. Didn't break its.
I've seen this thing do a somersault.
Yeah, well, I think you're absolutely right that, one, the technology can surprise us, but two, it has applications where it can actually result in meaningful improvements for how we live our lives and interact with it. So we need to, yes, be cautious, but also, you know, being a little bit excited. This is a good time where we can really be leading on new frontiers. So thank you so much to my co-host, Meredith Castles, for organizing all of the content for today and teeing up our guests. And once again, thank you to Dr. Paris Butfield, Dr. John Manning, Dr. Tim Nugent from Secret Lab for joining us in studio today. My name's Neve Chapman. You've been listening to That's What I Call Science, the weekly radio show and podcast supported by Edge Radio from Hobart, Tasmania. Go to edgeradio.org.au for more information. And please get in touch with us across our social media channels. Go to any of your major social media platforms and search for That's What I Call Science or That's Science Taz, and you'll find us and can get in touch with the team. Thank you. Talk to you next week.